is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I am Junior Duofo, and here's what's coming up.
If the October rains fail, that would be the third season in a row without rain. And we would, by the end of this year, be facing a much deeper crisis still.
That was Stephen Jackson, the World Food Program's resident coordinator in Kenya, on an emergency appeal for assistance to 1.3 million people hard as hit by a severe drought. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. The United Nations today sharply criticized Ethiopia's decision to expel seven of its senior officials, calling the decision a, quote, bombshell, unquote, that will hamper humanitarian operations in Tigray and neighboring insecure provinces. The UN says 5.2 million people in the Tigray region need urgent assistance as malnutrition worsens. Stephanie Tremblay, associate spokesperson for the UN Secretary General, told reporters there are hopes that the Ethiopian government will backtrack.
The UN is delivering life-saving aid, including food, medicine, water, and sanitation supplies to people in desperate need. I have full confidence in the UN staff who are in Ethiopia doing this work. The UN is committed to helping Ethiopian people who rely on humanitarian assistance. We are now engaging with the government of Ethiopia in the expectation that the concerned UN staff will be allowed to continue their important work. The humanitarian work by the UN is impartial. It's important. It needs to continue. We need and we hope to be able to continue this important work over there.
The U.S. House of Representatives passed the legislation yesterday requiring the U.S. administration to issue reports on those who seek to destabilize Libya, commit war crimes, or violate the U.S. arms embargo. The Libyan-American Alliance urged the Senate to follow suit so President Joe Biden can sign the Libya Stabilization Act into law. It was introduced in February by Congressman Ted Deutch. Ehsan Omach, president of the Washington-based Libyan-American Alliance, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi on the significance of this development for the future of a free and stable Libya.
The Libya Stabilization Act has been a great addition to a stronger U.S. diplomacy that wants to see a diplomatic solution to the conflict in Libya and one that wants to support the people of Libya. We have seen this bill born out of a erratic foreign policy advanced by President Trump after the attack on Tripoli by Haftar forces, where he actually made a phone call that, in fact, condoned some of those activities. What this was born out of is the need for U.S. legislators to ensure that the U.S. foreign policy regarding Libya is one that is governed by sound judgment as to who is the party that is supporting the cause of democracy in Libya. So when we see it at being advanced, where in fact it has been refined, it has been dealing with the current events in Libya, but also coming out, holding people who've committed crimes in Libya accountable, making sure that there's a role for the respective human rights in this, making sure that the foreign actors that have been wreaking havoc in Libya will be held accountable. And in fact, they're pushed so they can exit Libya and leave it in as a sovereign state that's violated by these proxy powers. We find this law to show not only increased concern and diplomacy from the U.S. Towards Libya, but also tools by which the president can inform his foreign policy and enable tools by which to sanction those who violate the reasons for stability and peace in Libya. So we think it's a good legislation. We hope that the Senate can, in fact, advance that bill quickly. So we're hoping this will go through, hoping that we'll get to the desk of President Biden soon for him to sign it into law.
The bill requires the administration also to articulate a strategy to deal with the Russian presence in Libya, especially the Wagner Group. How significant is that for the future of a democratic free Libya?
There's no question that one of the biggest threats to stability in Libya is the presence of the Russians and their destructive role, which is working out of a greater strategy of Russia to be involved in Africa, to be involved in places where it can draw the U.S. and NATO away from its own problems in Central Asia, Europe, and other places where Russia wants to have more free rein, not being held accountable against its transgressions. So Russia has been a very difficult component in the complexity of the conflict in Libya. By focusing U.S. diplomacy and by forcing the president, or at least putting conditions on the president's performance in Libya vis-a-vis addressing the threat of Russia, by listening to the AFRICOM, which has been sounding the alarm about the increasing role of Russia in the North Africa, in Libya, and the African Sahel and beyond, we find that this is a welcome addition. This is an important focus addressing that threat. We see it as part of the first portion of the law where it specifically wants reporting on the Russian activities, on the Russian objectives in Libya. It is holding the Wagner, which has been the mercenaries by Russia, held accountable for their crimes. It's holding the people who have worked with them and brought them to Libya accountable for their crimes, really, in introducing that major force into Libya. So clearly, one of the most important factors that can ensure stable democratic Libya is the removal of all of the foreign mercenaries, which we have seen commit horrific crimes against Libyans. And so it is high time for them to leave Libya once and for all.
Experts agree that U.S. leadership in Libya is crucial in stopping the ongoing foreign intervention in Libya, ending the conflict and paving the way for a stable Libya. What is needed from the Biden administration to assume this role?
Well, I think the U.S. has made its strategy clear in wanting to push for the elections in the soonest time frame possible, which is the December 24th. The U.S. diplomacy has been very heavily concentrated of late in ensuring that no difficulties are facing the Libya situation. We've seen U.S. diplomats, U.S. high officials visit Libya, insist on getting the elections on time. We have seen them cooperate with the High Council that is responsible for elections in Libya to ensure that they are provided any help and service that they need. The U.S. is also very much focused on ensuring that these are credible, transparent elections, ensure that we put a representative, legitimate government, and then address the exit of all actually mercenaries as well as governmental presence in Libya in ensuring that Libya remains free from any foreign intervention. I think what remains of friends of Libya that engage in international agreements with Libya is something that's done by the authority in Libya and one that can be managed based on the need for training or otherwise. But the spoiling effect and the dangerous effect of the presence of forces, whether they're militias or forces that are paramilitary or a proxy military for other countries, I think it's critical that we see an exit of all these forces outside of Libya.
That was Sam Omek, president of the Washington-based Libyan-American Alliance, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. Security forces fired tear gas yesterday in Sudan's capital to disperse thousands of protesters criticizing the slow transition to an all-civilian government as the current transitional system struggles to improve living conditions. The demonstration follows a reported coup attempt within the military that officials say they fended off last week and comes more than 2 years since authoritarian leader Omar al-Bashir was ousted. The military says the takeover attempt was cobbled together by Bashir loyalists. The military agreed to work with civilians to put together a transitional government after Bashir's ouster, but the joint effort has struggled to bolster the economy, attract foreign aid, and install democracy. Political fragmentation has created another hurdle. The Sudanese Professionals Association, which spearheaded the nationwide uprising that culminated in Bashir's ouster, issued a statement yesterday saying there was, quote, no way, unquote, to gain a democratic transition without ending the partnership with the military. A working committee will meet next week to iron out the details of the cooperation between South African Airways and Kenya Airways. Announced this week, it aims to help both entities cope with and recover from the COVID pandemic, as well as establish a pan-African airline in the future. Reporter Vicky Stark spoke to Kenya Airlines CEO Alan Kilavuka and airline economist Joachim Vamoten.
News of the cooperation agreement came just days after South African Airways relaunched after being grounded for 18 months during a business rescue process. While SAA's CEO was not available to comment, Kilavuka was keen to elaborate, saying through cooperation at a technical level and network alignment for both commercial and cargo business, the two airlines hope to support each other's aspirations for economic recovery. They also hope to boost tourism.
What we are trying to do here is give our customers opportunities to be able to choose a variety of routes, and in that sense, increase passenger traffic, of course, also cargo opportunities, and enhance the general trade. By taking advantage of the cooperation of the airlines and also of the two countries.
Asked about criticism that a cooperation agreement does not make sense since both airlines are battling financially, Kilavuka had this to say.
It's not exclusively Kenya Airways and South African Airways which are struggling. We are all struggling in the aviation industry and have received significant support from our governments, and so have other airlines as well. So I would say that it's not unique to us. That's a first step. And also, it's important to note that we are in a very depressed environment from a market point of view. And in this kind of an environment, it's best to consolidate your assets so that you can increase your economies of scale in order to be able to attack the market effectively.
He said establishing a Pan-African airline is a complicated process.
If it were up to me, it would be like yesterday, but we will have to take it step by step. So what we've said is we will get back to you in terms of timeline. We have set up a working committee. You know, the journey of 1,000 miles, as they say, begins with the first step. So we've taken the first step.
Speaking by phone, airlines economist Joachim Vermeuten cautioned both airlines to get the basics right and avoid overambitious expansion, saying that's what led to their ruin.
It's very important for both Kenya Airways and SAA to really look at the demand, because the demand is far lower than people expect it to be. It's about 30% of the demand of 2019 at the moment. And that balance of supply to demand is really going to be the trick. You know, if you look at the United States, up to about 2011, airlines were making large losses. And then suddenly the airline managers discovered how to balance your supply of capacity to your demand. And suddenly the industry became very profitable. I'm talking about pre-COVID.
Vermeuten added it is very unusual for two airlines from competing alliances to be cooperating. SAA is with the Star Alliance, while Kenya Airways is with the Sky Team. However, he wished them well. Vicky Stark for VOA News in Cape Town.
The United Nations is issuing a $139 million flash appeal to provide assistance to 1.3 million people in Kenya hardest hit by severe drought. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Millions of people across Kenya are suffering from two back-to-back seasons of poor rainfall, resulting in severe food shortages. The latest integrated phase classification, which analyzes the severity of food insecurity, finds nearly 370,000 Kenyans are in a state of emergency, and 2 million others are in crisis. World Food Program resident coordinator in Kenya, Stephen Jackson, speaking via Zoom from the capital, Nairobi, says acute malnutrition rates are rising rapidly. He says 465,000 children and 96,000 pregnant and lactating women are acutely malnourished. He warns many are at imminent risk without urgent nutritional feeding. On a visit to a clinic Thursday in Wajir, northern Kenya, he says people told him it had been more than a year since they last felt rain.
I spoke with a young mother, Zainab, who told me that she couldn't feed her children that morning and that she didn't know if she would be able to put food on the table that evening, and that many of her livestock have already died because of the drought, and those that are left are not in a good condition to sell. And you will know, of course, in northern Kenya, livestock is the basis of life.
Jackson says problems arising from drought are compounded by the COVID-19 pandemic, insecurity, the recent locust infestations and diseases. The Kenyan government so far has allocated about $17 million to assist the most vulnerable drought victims and has announced another $20 million for this effort. However, Jackson says that is not enough and support from international donors is needed.
The time to act is now. As I already stressed, if the October rains fail, that would be the third season in a row without rain. And we would, by the end of this year, be facing a much deeper crisis still, something on the order of what we saw 10 years ago. So any support that we can provide now will save lives and livelihoods.
The 2011 East Africa drought caused a severe food crisis across the region, threatened the livelihoods of 9.5 million people, and resulted in tens of thousands of deaths. The current appeal will provide food and livelihoods, special nutritional treatment for acutely malnourished children and women, access to water, sanitation and hygiene, health care, education, and other essential needs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Malawi's Constitutional Court yesterday began hearing a case brought by the opposition Democratic Progressive Party to try to overturn results of last year's rerun presidential election, which it lost. Defense lawyers are pushing for dismissal of the case, saying the claimants have flouted proper procedures. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
In June, the DPP petitioned the High Court to nullify the rerun election. It filed the petition soon after High Court Justice Kenyatta Nyirenda quashed the appointment of four DPP commissioners to the Electoral Commission, saying their appointment was invalid and unconstitutional. Former President Peter Mutharika appointed commissioners Jean Matanga, Linda Kunje, Steve Dua, and Arthur Nanturu during the 2020 rerun presidential elections. However, in the petition, the DPP said that the rerun election also needed to be nullified. It argues that Malawi should not recognize an election that was presided over by its own illegitimate commissioners. Attorney General Thabo Chakaka Nyirenda is the government's defense lawyer in the case. In his submission at the start of the hearing Wednesday, Nyirenda said the laws of Malawi only allow the president to vacate office by early resignation, incapacity to run the office, and through impeachment by the National Assembly.
Since the claimants want a nullification of the elections, the only way to do that would be by way of either petition under Section 100 of the or Section 114 of the Parliamentary and Presidential Elections Act. My lords, under the scheme, that challenge has to be done within 7 days of the declaration of the results.
Nyirenda also said the fact that the claimants made the challenge about 11 months after declaration of the election results makes the challenge invalid. Samuel Tembenu is among lawyers representing the DPP. He told the court that the petition could not be filed within the stipulated 7 days after elections because the dismissal of the commissioners happened long after the elections had ended. Tembenu, who was also a former Minister of Justice during the DPP administration, said this is not an election case, but rather a constitutional matter.
Therefore, I still submit, my ladies and my lords, that what is before you is a constitutional case. When it has been breached, consequences must flow according to the dictates of the law itself. This is a case that must be allowed to continue and to dismiss the objections raised by the Attorney General.
Nyirenda argued that only former President Mutharika, not the DPP, has the necessary interest to pursue the case. Tembenu countered that the courts are meant for every citizen.
The claimant in this matter, my ladies and my lords, is a registered political party which enjoys rights enshrined under Section 40 of the Constitution. It is a party that was consulted by the president to submit names of commissioners. If it lacks sufficient interest in that scenario, who else has then?
The Constitutional Court has given both parties 14 days to file written submissions before it decides whether or not to proceed with the case. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Uganda's government is threatening to close major bodies of water by the end of the year if fishermen don't halt poor practices that are depleting fish stocks and hurting fish processing and exports. Reporter Magume Davis Rakwaringi has more from Kampala, Uganda. Uganda's Fisheries Ministry issued 8 guidelines to improve fishing practices. These include a ban on use of boats below 28 feet, use of proper gear for the Nile perch, proper trading of fish maw, and supervised fish smoking. Adoa Helen is the state minister of fisheries.
Uganda's fisheries ministry issued 8 guidelines to improve fishing practices. These include a ban on use of boats below 28 feet, use of proper gear for the nile patch, proper trading of fish maw, and supervised fish smoking. Adoa Helen is the state minister of fisheries.
Fish inspectors must deploy at all border points to check on entry of illegal gears and exit of immature fish. And anyone got dealing with illegal gears will equally be arrested and tried. Failure to follow the 8 guidelines we have given, ministry will have no choice, and we shall not have any option but to close the major 3 lakes by December 2021.
The 3 lakes are Lake Victoria, Lake Edward, and Choga. Adoa says poor fishing practices have left fishing processing factories operating at a dismal 10% capacity, from 30,400 tons in 2020 to only 8,000 tons under threatening closure. There are 13 fish processing plants around Lake Victoria. The fishery subsector is one of the top foreign exchange earners for Uganda, raking in at least $175 million in 2019, according to the Ministry of Agriculture. The sector also accounts for 3% of the national GDP and is a source of livelihood for over 5 million Ugandans. She says one of the dangers facing the industry is the increased gutting of nile patch to remove the lucrative fish maw while leaving the fish behind. She says this contributes to water pollution. Giftomo Ashega, a fisherman from Gaba on Lake Victoria, denies the minister's version.
By her saying that, she will sink and close in the lake. Without coming there to understand, it's just going to cause a lot of suffering. See that kind of thing. More has got money. What about the flesh? You have people who can feed on the flesh. If you are those who are just looking for the carcass where the meat has been taken away and they're smoking them there.
The 40-year-old father of 3 says he depends on fishing to support his family. He earns some 35,000 Uganda shillings, or about $10 a day, which helps him to buy food and pay school fees and rent. He blames the government for not doing enough to control the entry of poor fishing material, which highly contributes to catching immature fish.
Certain type of nets, which this country is not making, are here in the lake. Like we have this woolen gauze net, which they talk about, is in the lake. Is here. It has lasted since those other ministers were there. They're here. In fact, this is what have weakened the fishing ministry.
He also accuses the Fisheries Protection Unit officers of taking bribes. Washega says the government should sensitize fishermen on better fishing practices. Speaking in local dialect, Luganda, Emmanuel Kibirige, another fisherman from Gaba, agrees.
Government Jimmyaro.
Instead of the government just arresting us fishermen, it should rather come and provide us with better fishing equipment, such as better fishing nets on credit basis, which we can repay on a yearly basis. This can help better our lives, and we can stop bad fishing practices.
Minister Adoa admits some of the officers in the Fisheries Protection Department are involved in corruption and warns they'll be apprehended. She also says the government is working on a law to streamline the fisheries industry. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinjiri, Kampala, Uganda.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I am Junior Luafo in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20.